Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Airwave Podcast, an anesthesia podcast for medical students. My name is Peru, and joining me are my co-hosts, Alexa and Grace. If you haven't guessed already, today is another special day because we have an exciting guest speaker interview. But before we get started, I want to give a quick shout out to Alexa, one of our co-hosts, who is now a new R1 anesthesia resident at the University of British Columbia.
That's right, Peru. We're super excited for Alexa to be starting this new chapter in her career, and we're also as excited to introduce our guest speaker today. We are incredibly lucky to be joined by Dr. Richard Cooper. He is a professor emeritus in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Toronto. He spent his career as a clinical anesthesiologist at University Health Network and Toronto General Hospital from 1981 to 2019. He was the founder and former director of the Anesthesia Advanced Airway Fellowship at Toronto General Hospital and the past president of the Society for Airway Management from 2012 to 2014. He is a member of various professional societies and has been a lecturer at the ASA Annual Scientific Meeting and World Airway Management Meeting. His academic interests include alternatives to direct laryngoscopy, clinical applications of video laryngoscopy, and extubation of the difficult airway. He has authored many original articles, editorials, 30 book chapters, and was the co-editor of The Difficult Airway, an atlas of tools and clinical and techniques in clinical management. Outside of medicine, Dr. Cooper is an avid bread baker, luthier, and violinist and endurance athlete, and has completed over 25 marathons.
So without further ado, take a listen to our conversation with Dr. Cooper. Well, Dr. Cooper, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. We're very excited that you can join us today.
My pleasure to be here.
Again, likewise, we're very excited to have you here, and I'm sure our listeners are equally as excited. So maybe to kick things off, you can tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in anesthesia.
Well, that was almost by accident. My entry into medical school was a little bit delayed. I had done a master's degree before going into medical school, and I did that in physiology. So I had a good solid background in physiology, and I was interested in things that sort of a quantitative approach to medicine, things that could be measured and could be manipulated. And I guess also it appealed to me that I would only have to focus on basically one patient at a time. The idea of a waiting room filled with patients and knowing whether or not you had done your job well sometimes take 6 months or 2 years. I was not mature enough to entertain that kind of delayed gratification. So, in any case, going back to the specific appeal of anesthesia, I had a good strong background in physiology and in pharmacology at the graduate level, but I really had never considered anesthesia as a career option because it had a relatively low profile in my undergraduate exposure. I started off in internal medicine because I felt that I really did not have a sufficiently thorough grounding in medicine, and I wasn't prepared to be a primary care physician with what I felt I had been the tools I felt I had been provided with. And after 2 years, or during my second year in a residency in internal medicine, I realized that I was spending a disproportionate amount of my time consulting on patients in the intensive care unit. And it really intrigued me that that the intensivists could manipulate heart rate and blood pressure and PCO2 and PO2 and play with the electrolytes. And there were just so many things that they were able to approach quantitatively. And they all seemed to be really enjoying themselves. So I did an elective in critical care, and that was sort of a 2-week elective, and I really enjoyed it. And I really saw that as being the direction in which I wanted to go. But still thinking about it in terms of internal medicine. So what I arranged to do was something that was possible in my day, but not so easily accomplished now, was I arranged to do a year of anesthesia so that I could get better, more familiar with mechanical ventilation, inserting intravenous arterial lines, Swan-Ganz catheters, etc. And after about 1 or 2 weeks of doing anesthesia as what was supposed to be just a 1 year sojourn or whatever, I said, this is just, you know, this is so much fun. And I'm having way more fun than I have doing rounds in internal medicine. And as the time went on, I decided that really this is where I wanted to spend the rest of my professional career. And I was fortunate enough to be able to do that. I switched from internal medicine into anesthesia. The year that I spent was credited towards an anesthesia residency. And when I finally finished my anesthesia residency, I got the best of both worlds because I was invited to become part of the staff of the medical intensive care unit. So I got to take care of the most critically ill patients, which excited me. The sickest patients in internal medicine at a very good hospital. So I got to spend about a quarter of my time doing critical care and three quarters of my time doing anesthesia. And it was probably 5 years before I started to say, you know, I can't believe they actually pay me to do this. This is so much fun and it's so gratifying. So that's sort of the shorter version of how I ended up in anesthesiology. And I, after 40 years of practicing, I had no regrets. For me, it was the right career choice to make.
And as someone who's just beginning my residency in anesthesia, that's definitely great to hear. And I know a lot of my reasons for joining the specialty definitely mirror yours, the love of the physiology and the pharmacology, and that, you know, there's a genuine enjoyment in going to work and that you get to deploy that knowledge and use that to make that patients have a positive perioperative experience and that their pain is well controlled and all those other things. So far I found it to be very rewarding as well. And I hope that I have, you know, 40 years from now, I'll also be able to look back and say that, you know, I have zero regrets. Another thing, Dr. Cooper, that I actually want to ask you about, and again, in beginning my training, one thing that I find to be very comforting as I'm building my skills for laryngoscopy is knowing that, okay, if there's a difficult airway, well, I can always ask for the GlideScope or airway adjuncts. And so I'm curious as to how your work with the GlideScope came about. And at what point did you realize that this was a device that certainly had its place in difficult airway management?
Well, I take a slightly different perspective on that question than the way you've posed it. And I'll try to explain that to you. I had an interest in airway management that probably grew as a result of being part of a multidisciplinary intensive care unit where most of my colleagues, in fact, there were four of us for the most part, they were in internal medicine and I was the only anesthesiologist. So I was often the person that was consulted when it came to managing difficult airways. And I had one patient in particular. I had lots of patients that were especially challenging. But one patient in my first, I think we were probably going to talk about extubation a little later on, but I'll bring it up at this juncture because it was for me, it was formative. And it actually happened during my first 6-month rotation as an anesthesia resident. I had a young lady who was having cosmetic surgery on her jaw. At the end of the surgery, her jaws were wired shut and she was nasally intubated, had been nasally intubated. And she was electively intubated and ventilated overnight in the intensive care unit. And afterwards, the following morning, everyone agreed, all the appropriate people agreed that it was the right time for her to be extubated. She fulfilled all the criteria. So she was extubated, and almost immediately she obstructed her airway. And with her jaws wired shut, reintubation was very challenging. In fact, it was not successful. It could not be accomplished. And there were multiple approaches to managing her airway, including an effort to cut the wires and blind nasal intubation. And as they were preparing to do a front of neck access or a cricothyrotomy, or in those days, an emergency tracheostomy, she arrested. Now, bear in mind, this was a long time ago. These were days that predated oximetry and capnography. So the only way we could tell that she was in dire state was that she started to become first tachycardic and then bradycardic, and then her QRS complexes widened and she became dusky blue. And this was at the same time that they had tried to intubate her orally, nasally. They were starting to prepare her neck, and then she arrested. So within the space of a few minutes, this 21-year-old girl who came in for cosmetic surgery had her chest open, internal cardiac massage, bilateral chest tubes, blood issuing from her nose, blood issuing from her mouth, and unfortunately, she died. So that case, which happened 42, 43 years ago, continues to haunt me to this day. And that sparked an interest in extubation of the difficult airway, which we can come back to later. But it, more broadly speaking, I became more and more interested in managing the difficult airway in critical care and in the operating room. Now, when we do direct laryngoscopy, which is the way that most patients are intubated today, we're basically doing it exactly the same way that it was done quite a long time ago. The Macintosh blade and the straight McGill blade, or Miller blade rather, they were developed in the early 1940s. And basically what that technique involves is it might as well involve a candle or a flashlight and a soup spoon. You use the spoon to retract the tongue, and you hope that you have a direct line of sight from your eyeball to the larynx. And it would surprise a lot of people to know, even a lot of airway specialists, that about 6% of the time in adults, more in kids, 6% of the time in adult patients who have seemingly normal airways, normal anatomy, and who are managed by anesthesiologists, skilled airway practitioners, supposedly the experts in their field, about 6% of the time, direct laryngoscopy fails to reveal the larynx. Now, our terminology uses terms like difficult and awkward, and it refers primarily to intubation. So if you get a tube in and you never see the larynx, what do you call it? Well, I think it's important to differentiate between laryngoscopy and intubation. And if you don't see the larynx, a procedure that is an oscopy is not difficult or awkward. It fails. So if you call it what it is, if you recognize that 6% of the time, seemingly normal airways managed by competent experts in the field will fail at direct laryngoscopy, there really ought to be a strong impetus to find a better approach. All right. So how did I get involved with this? This is a long-winded answer, but I think it provides context. I had already established myself as having an interest in airway management. And at one of the meetings that was a national meeting that was held in Toronto, a surgeon came up to me by the name of Jack Pacey, who kind of was cloak and dagger. By the way, I'd be interested in showing you a device that I've been working on. Would you be willing to meet me for breakfast tomorrow morning and we'll talk about it? And so I met with Dr. Pacey and his partner, Auni Ayubi, who was an electrical engineer, and both of whom I've remained very good friends with since, to this day. And he showed me this device that was pretty crude looking. It actually consisted of, a ureteroscope. He says, no, it wasn't. It was an arthroscope. But in any case, it was a scope, and it was attached to a plastic delivery system that was shaped like a ski slope. And basically, you put the endotracheal tube in a slot, and you visualize by looking through this telescope into the airway. You could look around corners. So this was a crude device, but it worked. And in those days, you could use unapproved devices. I think you could. Unapproved devices in patients without having to have, we didn't have formal approval from Health Canada, from the hospital. It was probably foolish on my part, but it worked and it was crude. And I wasn't all that enthralled by it. But a couple of years later, we continued to correspond. He continued to share his experience with me. A couple of years later, the technology had evolved to the point that they now had little chips. It was basically a camera on a chip called, this was CMOS, or complementary metal oxide semiconductors. So a little chip that could be embedded into a laryngoscope that looked fairly familiar to a regular laryngoscope. And when he put this in my hand, it was a game changer. Now I could look around corners. I could look into a mouth where all I might see is the uvula, but I had a perfect view of the larynx. Now, just backing up a little bit, I told you we wouldn't get through all your questions. Backing up a little bit, I had had experience with other devices that allowed for indirect visualization of the larynx. So that approach really appealed to me. And this was a relatively familiar device. Most of the others were not. This was a relatively familiar device that allowed great visualization, but it was a new skill. And that skill came probably more naturally to me because of the other devices that I had been using for many, many years. So it suddenly being able to see the larynx in almost anyone in whom you could fit the device into their mouth just struck me as being so, not evolutionary, revolutionary. Now you mentioned that I'm going to back up and address. I said I would take this from in a slightly different direction. You mentioned that it's comforting to know that there is a device that you can use, as you can resort to if direct laryngoscopy fails. My approach would be the opposite. My approach would be that if you rely on that device, particularly one that is not a conventional laryngoscope, but like a Macintosh-style blade, but with a camera, that device is a marginal improvement over regular direct laryngoscopy. It allows you to share your view with other people, which is advantageous. Often allows you to record your view, which allows for image capturing, for clinical documentation, etc. It allows for much better instruction because you can get real-time mentorship by someone who can see what you're seeing. So it has those advantages, but it doesn't really provide you with much of an improved view. So if you now take a video laryngoscope that is what we call hyperangulated, that is bent to a more extreme degree, that provides you with a consistently better view, but it also means that a direct view is no longer possible. So what you see when you look in the mouth is different from what you see looking on the screen. That means that you have to be able to manipulate your right hand just as effectively as you manipulate your left hand. Okay, so that's kind of like playing the piano, where the left hand plays the bass and the right hand plays the melody. If you haven't learned the hand-eye coordination or how to manipulate your right and your left hand in a coordinated manner, you won't be able to rely on that hyperangulated video laryngoscope. That's why I turn the statement around, that I would use a hyperangulated video laryngoscope in the easy airways, so I develop that expertise. That way, I can more confidently rely upon it as a rescue device. So my approach is completely different from the traditional approach. Does that make sense to you?
No, it definitely does. And I've heard time and time again that just because you get the view as a result of the hyperangulation does not mean that intubation and passing the core or passing the tube is necessarily easy as a result of that angle that you now need to navigate effectively. And simply, again, because you can see it, and you might even deceive yourself by saying, oh, that's such a great view, does not make tube placement necessarily easier.
Right. My position on that is that that is just a technical challenge. And it's a technical challenge that is easily overcome by deliberate practice. And if you use your hyperangulated blade as your primary device and you use direct laryngoscopy as your backup rescue device in easy airways, you'll gradually become more and more confident. It's a technical skill that is easily learned if properly taught. And I posed this challenge to a colleague of mine in Melbourne, Australia. He calls it the Cooper Challenge. This is the guy who invented the vortex airway approach, Nicholas Crimes. And we met at a conference in St. Gallen in Switzerland. And I said to him, if you give me 5 minutes of your time, I will teach you how to use a hyperangulated blade the way I use it, and it will change your practice. And then what I would suggest you do is you use it consistently for 3 months. Well, he says that I told him to use it for 6 months, but he said his practice was completely transformed. And now he only uses a hyperangulated video laryngoscope if it's available. So he refers to that as the Cooper Challenge. And he is, has promoted that fairly widely in Australia.
That makes a lot of sense. And I'm curious in your practice, and this is an argument that I've heard with using direct laryngoscopy, but video laryngoscopy is the cost of each blade, and that, you know, paying the $50 for a disposable GlideScope blade, for example, is prohibitive. And that's one of the reasons that people still kind of revert to direct. Or another argument is that you need to maintain that direct laryngoscopy, if you will, is a, I don't want to say a dying field, but a field in which you need to make sure that you keep up your skills. I'm wondering if you have a perspective on that, or if you would be an advocate for, or it sounds like you are, just first pass all the time video laryngoscopy.
Well, given that direct laryngoscopy is very widely available, video laryngoscopy is increasingly available, but it is not always available. So let me give you an analogy. It's now the standard of practice, standard of care, when inserting a central venous line to use ultrasound. Now, I practiced anesthesia for 30 years before I ever saw an ultrasound device. And I was much faster at doing doing central venous cannulation without ultrasound, but it now became the standard of care. And I think with increasing practice, I became more proficient at central venous cannulation. Now, but what would happen if an ultrasound was not available? And what happens to someone who began their practice when it was the standard of care and they had never performed central venous cannulation without ultrasound? Likewise, when laparoscopic surgery first began, it was taking our surgeons, and very good surgeons, it was taking them 4 hours to do a cholecystectomy, laparoscopic cholecystectomy. And a really good surgeon could do an open cholecystectomy in 45 minutes. I had occasion a few years ago to have a laparoscopic cholecystectomy myself. And was professionally favored because I got the first case. I was the first case of the day, but I was home for lunch and I shoveled snow that afternoon. So that wasn't recommended. In fact, it was specifically, I was told not to do anything so foolish. But there's no question that there are growing pains when new technologies are introduced, but there are huge benefits to practicing that new technology once the groundwork has been established and there are good mentors out there. Did I answer your question? I'm forgetting now what your question was.
Yes, yes, you did, for sure.
Thanks for that, ending off on that note, actually, about, you know, ultrasound guided techniques. I find that even with med student level material, such as inserting arterial lines, there's a growing interest to sort of teach students to do it with an ultrasound. Just kind of switching gears a little bit. Sure. Do you mind sort of telling us a little bit more about your work and your experience in leading safe extubations of challenging airways? Because that's arguably the other side of the coin.
Okay. Well, I mentioned the case that was my index case, that young woman who presented for cosmetic surgery involving her jaw. And it occurred to me that I never wanted to see anything like that again. It was a horrible thing to witness. I felt completely powerless. I was surrounded by people who assumed responsibility, but they were doing it in a very disorganized, discoordinate manner. And some years later, in the intensive care unit, I became aware that we could do something along the lines of a stylet that would provide access to the airway even after the endotracheal tube was removed. And I guess it was 1989 when my attention was drawn to an article that talked about something that was referred to as a jet stylet. And this jet stylet was something that was fashioned from PVC tubing that was 4 millimeters in diameter that you could insert within the endotracheal tube and then remove the endotracheal tube over this catheter. The catheter would remain in situ. And if the patient desaturated, the idea was it could be used as a conduit for administering oxygen by jet ventilation. Well, at the time, jet ventilation was really popular as a rescue maneuver. Subsequently, it's grown out of favor because of the risk of barotrauma. But I thought that I communicated with the authors of that publication of the jet stylet named Bedger and Chang. And I proposed that they consider a collaboration incorporating what I thought was it would enhance the safety of the device. And I never heard from them despite multiple attempts to contact them. And I pursued that with Cook Medical, And we developed something called an airway exchange device or an airway exchange catheter. And now these are used very widely with around the world. They're available in a number of sizes. And there are several other companies that manufacture them too. And in fact, another Canadian company called CardioMed made one to differing specifications that I subsequently felt would enhance safety even more. So I had a particular interest in patients who, I remember I mentioned an alternative device to direct laryngoscopy that predated the video laryngoscope. Well, there was a device that was developed by someone by the name of Bullard, and it was developed around 1982. And I happen to have two of these at our hospital, both of which I acquired by twisting some arms. And this had a profile of 6 millimeters. That meant that if you could get something about the thickness of a spoon in the patient's mouth, you could look around corners and be able to see the larynx. And I was particularly interested, and I had great fun using this device because I would transport it around the operating room with this cart that had a big 24-inch TV and a camera, and it just helped me cultivate an image of eccentricity, because everyone else's laryngoscope would fit very nicely on top of their anesthetic cart, and mine required a couple of people to push this big cart around the operating room. Anyhow, I could put this in someone's mouth who had ankylosis of the temporomandibular joint. And we were seeing a lot of patients with oral surgery who had TM joint dysfunction, who could barely open their mouth. And these became my, you know, I was always called upon to manage the patients who had retrognathia, who had TM joint dysfunction, who could barely open their mouth. And I was the guy that, I loved it. And so what happened at the end of the operation was many of these patients would have their jaws immobilized. So their mandible and maxilla would be wired together. And their jaws would be, so their jaws were wired shut. Once again, if you remove the tube and can't put it back in, then these patients' life is in serious jeopardy. So I developed this catheter that allowed us to extubate the patients more safely. And in fact, with the passage of time, what we ended up doing was modifying our anesthetic technique. So rather than loading them up with enough narcotics to keep them asleep for 24 hours, we were essentially waking them up in the recovery room within a couple of hours of their surgery. And if they didn't have a lot of swelling, we would extubate them over this tube exchanger or airway exchange catheter. So I published on 212 cases involving either the prototype or one of the commercial devices. And after publishing that paper, I got invited to speak at a number of international meetings, wrote some book chapters on extubation of the difficult airway. And I was the only one that was actually addressing this topic. In fact, the first book chapter that I wrote on the subject, it took me a year and a half to come up with the references for the chapter. And by the fifth edition of Benemoff's book on airway management, which is now Hegberg's Airway Management, it has over 400 references. So extubation of the difficult airway is now part of any serious discussion or major discussion about airway management. And I'm pleased that this device has been so widely used. I'm displeased with the fact that I had no commercial interests in this. And in fact, that was done deliberately. I had an opportunity get royalties, but I declined because I would rather not have a commercial investment so I could speak without a perceived conflict of interest.
Well, it's really exciting to hear all those stories and kind of how the tools we use today were developed, and I could just listen to this forever. No. We kind of like to ask...
Are you saying that my answers are very long-winded?
No, I think they are very well said, and kind of, I like the conclusions that we come to as well, kind of, and how that kind of influences practice today. I think I glance over the history of all these things, but it clearly has played a very important role to come up with these devices. But what we like to ask kind of all our speakers is if what advice you have for new trainees, whether that be new residents, fellows, or even medical students who are interested in anesthesia. So it was kind of a vague question, but whether it be career advice, life advice, what would you say to new trainees?
Well, I think it's important to maintain a balance. Medicine, perhaps this is true of other professions. I can't speak to those, but I can speak to medicine. And I chose to practice at I spent almost 40 years at Toronto General Hospital. I was privileged to be able to participate in the care of some of the sickest patients in the country. In fact, perhaps I would say some of the sickest patients in the world. I worked with outstanding physicians, outstanding allied health professionals and nurses, all of whom were very dedicated to their work. Most of the people that you work with in medicine, and probably true of other professions as well, are high achievers and make incredible demands upon themselves and have high expectations of others. And so you're always looking at somebody who is more productive, who's written more papers, who's spoken at more meetings, who puts in longer hours, who has a better publication profile than you do. And it's very easy to get sucked into that. It's very rare that you will ever feel in your career that you're functioning at the highest possible level you can ever function at. And what often happens is you end up shortchanging yourself and those who ought to matter to you most. So I think my wife and my children got the short straw in that bargain. I had a very fulfilling career. I went to work and I would be rewarded not only by the gratitude that I felt from my patients, but by the esteem that I tell myself my colleagues regarded me with, particularly those who respected my airway skills. I think they relied on me, and that only encourages you to continue to make those personal sacrifices that other people pay a price for. I mean, clearly some people benefit, but the people who ought to be most dear to you are the ones who pay a price. Now, I was fortunate. I had a lot of other interests outside of medicine. They probably contributed to what little semblance of sanity I was able to maintain. And so you have to have an outside outlet. For me, a lot of it was long distance running. I also had some, I became interested in sculpting, and later on I resumed my interest in music. I made a violin. I started taking violin lessons after a brief pause of 47 years. All those things, I think, contributed to some semblance of balance. But it's very easy to get, there may be a risk that they worsen the situation because you you have dedicated time to indulge yourself in those passions that you feel you're entitled to outside of your work. So you've got to define your priorities and define them clearly, and be willing to modify them as life circumstances dictate.
Well, thank you for that very insightful advice. I think that's really going to resonate with
Well, I had a discussion with my wife this morning about that very issue. It doesn't stop. But you have to have those ongoing discussions. Be mm-hmm. open to that. You know, I felt that what could be more important than the care I was providing to my patients? And other people, those who were important to me, paid the price. Fortunately, they stuck by me.
So I know we discussed the idea of balance in terms of professional versus personal lives. And if you could kind of rewind the clock a little bit, what are maybe one or two other things that you would do differently professionally or personally?
I'm not sure what I would do. I have to say that looking back, I am very grateful for the opportunities that I had. I'm kind of avoiding an insightful answer to your question. It's a good question. Even the last day of work, I felt very fulfilled. Even 2 years after retiring, and I've been retired now for 2 years and 3 weeks, I continue to have dreams about providing care to challenging situations, having the opportunity of teaching medical students who were far brighter than I was, who asked challenging questions, and I knew sometimes that I was giving them less than satisfactory answers. I know one bit of advice that I got from when I was considering changing from internal medicine to anesthesia. The guy who was really, he was the chief of medicine at St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto. He was a silver-haired fox, a really smart, smart guy. He said, just go to work and be prepared to be kicked in the ass. Because you've got to be critical of yourself and always be mindful that when somebody asks you a question and you're giving them an answer that you know is not honest or does not completely address their, be humble. So maybe if there's a grain of wisdom in that, the more I talk, the less wise I will seem. So we'll leave it at that.
Well, I definitely think that there's some wisdom in that, in being humble, and just that throughout an entire career, I'm sure that you face, you know, new challenges day in and day out. And I think part of what makes a specialty, you know, what it is and truly special is that you need to approach those difficult situations with humility and realize that you have a team that you can rely upon, to realize that you will need to continue to refine your skills to get better, to meet the demands of those challenging situations. And I think in a way that really pushes you to become better. And I think I can only infer that that's part of the reason why you still have dreams about providing, you know, that high level of patient care, just because you've been forced, you know, time and time and again to meet the demands of those challenges. So I think I can safely say from my perspective that I have a lot to look forward to for the remainder of my career. And it's definitely been great hearing from you and your experiences. So from myself, Grace Peru, we sincerely want to thank you for your time today. And I really hope our listeners were also able to find insight in your discussions today, and I'm sure that they will. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. It was nice talking with you.
And that concludes our episode with Dr. Cooper. We hope that this episode showed you just how rewarding a career in anesthesia can be. We hope that Dr. Cooper's advice can be useful to any medical student that may be considering anesthesia as a possible career path.
As always, keep in touch with us over our Twitter and Instagram at Airwave Podcast, and message us with any questions or comments. If you want short summaries of our episodes, check out our website for show notes. We have a great series of episodes on pharmacology and physiology topics still being published, so keep an eye out for that as well. And until next time, keep working hard, stay healthy, stay safe, take some nice deep breaths, and count back from 10.